You're listening to Sound Opinions, and later in the show, we're going to look at how record stores are changing to meet the moment. But first, we've got comedian Hannibal Buress with us.
This from the latest collection, my boy, you can copy the wave when I drop it to Summer Fiends. Got the city up under the wing like it's fried rice. I done died twice, I got nine lives, let me seven to spare. Fishing blurry.
A couple of weeks ago, we did a heartbreaking show about how COVID-19 is hurting music venues, especially the independent ones all across the country. But in addition to bands not being able to tour, a lot of comedians are also losing their biggest source of income, having to come up with whole new ways to do their thing and make a living from it. Hannibal Buress is used to performing for thousands in venues like the Chicago Theater. But if you haven't been to one of his live shows, you might know him from television, the Eric Andre Show, Broad City, or one of his stand-up specials, including the latest, Miami Nights.
This month, he's trying out a creative way to perform live comedy during a pandemic by doing a stand-up tour at drive-in movie theaters across the Midwest, including September 27th here in Chicago. Let's welcome Hannibal Buress. Hannibal, thanks for coming on the show.
What's up? How's it going?
We're hanging in as best anybody can in these isolated times.
I was in L.A. for a few months, and it's nice being in Chi today, to feel a shift, it's nice to feel a shift instead of constant heat.
Well, you're indicating you're back in the Chi. Grew up in the Austin neighborhood of Chicago. It is deep in you, in your routines, in your love of hip hop. I think you can't hide the Chicago in Hannibal. We are interested in the way music has informed your comedy from the beginning.
Yeah. I had recorded raps before I ever did a comedy set. And I started out doing comedy in 2002 in Carbondale, Illinois, Southern Illinois University. And my first real gig was hosting Sunday school sessions. DJ Tony Trim, he used to go by DJ Echoes. He had this open mic in his place. It was poets, musicians, comedians, everybody. And so from the very beginning, I've been pretty adjacent to music, and I battle rapped a couple times even in the beginning of my career. So it's always been really ingrained in what I do.
What about, I've been hearing for at least 2 years that you've been working on a hip hop record. Where are we at with that?
I have some tunes that's, half finished, worked on. If I had to rush and put out a project, I could put out a project of 10 joints.
Yeah.
sometimes overthinking stuff. And I think I got to just get a kind of a organized system together to really complete the music. I don't know when, but yeah, there's a bunch of tunes locked away.
So Hannibal, killer soundtrack in your comedy routines, ranging from The Roots to ASAP Rocky to Rocket Man by Elton John, trying to take it back from the President of the United States. How do you choose? How do you choose the music when you're performing?
If it's a song that I just have to keep repeating over and over and has a good build, then I'll try that as an intro song. And I really like the first, 30 seconds, a minute. Then that's Marijuana by Chrome Sparks. The build on that is really, and it just has that drop. It's certain things is perfect for just walking, and it has a build. You can put some video to anticipation and whatnot. It also gives me a little minute to kind of set myself into performance mode, it gives me that extra 30 seconds or whatever, 45 to, okay, this is where I'm about to hit the stage. The Danny Brown with Rusty, the attack where he's just really rapping and then that drop comes in. It's a nice build to have the shift.
Am
a maniac. Brainiac when I'm aiming at. Knock your brain up hack when I got that. You can't block that. It's just brain no hack.
Rocket Man, we started doing as a joke, but it actually really is a good walkout song because of the same thing. Yeah. It's a build, and actually the way we would do Rocket Man, I did it as just, I did maybe just did it two or three times for casino gigs, but it was, because it was in my mind, like, oh, it's older people at the casino, let's put on Rocket Man, see how it
goes. Yeah, they're Elton's age, so yeah.
Let's see how this can see. the direction on it would be, I would have a stage blackout and then a single spotlight on DJ Tony Tram. Song starts, he's just pointing to the sky. Which is, I think Rocket Man don't drop until maybe, I think it's a smooth minute and 20 seconds for the drop on this. So it's a long build. And so, yeah, he's just standing there pointing to the sky. And then I'll walk on Rocket Man.
Yeah, yeah.
The casino goes crazy.
Miami Nights, a surprise success when it started showing in July in YouTube. Not surprising, because it's you. That we expect you to be successful. But, you know, in these times when there is no live comedy, it gave us something, right? Something to laugh about. And it's great. And there's 10 things I want to ask you about being the medium famous comic that you are, as you say, at part of your routine. The other thing that a lot of people who were raving about it, TV critics, were saying about this special, accidentally topical. It is set in Miami. You're telling a story about, back when you were drinking. You're not drinking anymore. A cop seeing you on the street, and you're saying, hey, man, you know, you're here to protect and serve. Would you serve me? Call me an Uber. And it winds up with you in jail. That meant something different, no doubt, when it happened, than it would today, right? Post what we've seen across the country, really.
Yeah. It was more relevant just because the world was slowed down when these more recent incidents happened, but it's a constant. And it's a lot of people in those gigs that aren't really fit for the gig emotionally. And just from a maturity level, you should be more mature than the drunk comedian just saying stuff to you. You know what I mean? In that moment. But he did follow me. Like the interaction, it had a clear endpoint. And so that's the thing, where it could have been done if he's just like, you know what, we had words, that was that. No crimes committed, it's a drunk guy. I work in Miami, people are drunk. But now, all of a sudden, you're saying a drunk person, this person's too drunk to go into a bar in Miami, which is, that's a personal issue with you and me. So when you have people making those type of decisions in the moment, isn't that great?
Now I'm in the back of the car. He's up front. You could have just called me an Uber, dog. Now you the one driving.
You're going to get the same thrill on your drive-in tour. This is, you're making a little bit of comedy history, comedy and music. The venues that you're playing are drive-in theaters. Let's see how this goes is what the name of the tour is. So what's the deal with that? How did you cook that one up, and how do you think it's going to go? Are you kind of nervous about it? This is new territory for you.
It is. I saw that the company Hotbox, they did some shows with Bert Kreischer. From the videos I've seen, his shows went crazy. He put on a great show for his fans. And they reached out about doing a tour. And since they've been, it's been going well, they've ran things really tight, been really safe about it, and been able to provide a good experience for folks and for the fans and for the artists. I wanted to get out there and try, just because, you know, just put out a special. So it's, you want to be able to ride the wave and go see some folks. So I'm excited about the shift and the challenge. I do want the show to be funny, but I'm thinking more about feel, flow, aesthetic, and timing. I'm trying to, you know, I'm not going to do a show that I would do in the Chicago theater.
Right.
They would have some overlaps. Maybe there's some stuff that would, but the show will be aware that we're performing in a drive-in theater in the middle of the apocalypse. late September 2020. Yeah. It's a heated, heavy time. So the production and the performance will reflect it all.
Cool.
Well, Hannibal Buress, we need to laugh. Thank you for making us laugh. Miami Nights is killer. Star of stage and screen. I'm excited about this tour. And I'm waiting for that album, man. I want to hear that record.
We're waiting. We want an advance copy, yeah, man. We're critics. This is our job.
Just because you've been on the show, music,
you know, we're not going to give it a pass. If it sucks, we're going to say it sucks. Yeah. But
hey, I wouldn't want y'all to gas it up. You know, I wouldn't want that. I could.
All right. You know what?
I was thinking about this the other day, where, you know, I put out the track "Judge Judy," which is. I could have done better. It's fun, but it's like, you know.
It is funny.
It's fun. It's like weird, but it's like, as far as my musical output, I think I know I'm capable of better, but it's out and it's fine.
Yeah.
But I think about, if there's anybody, maybe somebody overseas that came across it, and that's all they know of. They just saw this Judge Judy song. Like on Apple Music, you can see where people Shazammed it. And like, yeah, Shazammed 8 times in Russia.
Yeah, and they got no context for Judge Judy there.
So it is. I like the idea of somebody hearing my track, Judge Judy, wherever, like, what is this? At a house party, or I don't know where, but some bar, like, let's Shazam that. Okay.
We have been talking to Hannibal Buress on Sound Opinions. It's been an honor. Thank you so much, Hannibal, for coming on the show.
Later, y'all.
Hannibal's adapting to living in a COVID world by doing his first drive-in theater tour. We're going to hear what record stores are doing differently after a quick break. Plus, we'll talk about a recent documentary on the beloved New York City record store, Other Music. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions from Chicago, distributed nationally by PRX.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot with Jim DeRogatis, and this week we're looking at how record stores are faring in this extremely trying time. Now, we do not have to justify the value, the importance of record stores on this show.
No.
But I tell you, in the world of digital streaming, I mean, technically they should be a relic, but record stores to me are more relevant than ever. That tactile experience, the fact that they have these beautiful physical artifacts that play this incredible stuff that we call music. I mean, that to me is like one of the great joys of living in the world. And thank God that they still exist.
They're also centers of community, Greg.
Absolutely.
You know, I talk about Lester Bangs a lot, forming my musical conscience. I think second on that list to who made Jim a music critic was Bill Ryan, this surly guy behind the counter at Pier Platters in Hoboken. I'd come in, it'd be a rainy Saturday afternoon. Nobody's in the store. Bill would look at me, right? He'd say,
you ever hear the Soft Boys?
And I'm like, no, I never did. Put the needle down. I want to destroy you. Yeah. He's got my $10 right away. And that's how it was for years. Before we dive into the state of record stores today, we're going to start with a beloved store that hasn't survived, Other Music in New York City. Greg, this was a store that was right across the street from the big Tower Records.
Yeah, right.
Tower is there, multi-stories, big, glossy, glitzy, and then there's Other Music. Mm-hmm. See, you get it? That was the title. And Other Music included krautrock, bizarre, weird synthesizer experimental jams, and world music, and deep cut, dusty soul, you name it. If it was off the beaten path, you could find it at Other Music, along with people who would sell it to you happily, who knew an encyclopedic amount about all of this.
The staff recommendations alone were worth it. I walked out with an armful of CDs or records every time I went there, because the stuff was so cool and so esoteric and so difficult to find otherwise.
It closed in 2016, and documentary filmmakers Rob Hatch Miller and Paloma Basu were there to capture what it meant to that community in New York City. If you're missing going to record stores in this time of COVID, this documentary is a close substitute, a real film about the joy of music, and you can watch it on Amazon Prime. I started talking to them by asking why they decided to make the film.
It was born of necessity. I mean, the store announced that it was closing, and it was a place that we both had long relationships to. I had worked there when I was in college and after college. Paloma had shopped there for years and years, and we had actually met through a mutual friend, Dwayne Harriet, who worked at Other Music with me and is in the film. And when they announced the closure was coming up in 6 weeks, in the summer of 2016, we went there after work, and we just saw a film happening around us.
You know, people coming in crying, news crews. It was just really, really, really charged. And it felt like someone has to do something, because it'll just die and then that'll be it. It'll be in people's memories. And, you know, it'll just be another New York institution that's gone.
Yeah. Not that far from CBGB, a couple blocks away, which is now a John Varvatos boutique. It kills me every time I'm back in the, you know.
Yeah, and you bring up CBGBs. I mean, we really wanted to document Other Music because we felt like if there was a central place in that early 2000s New York City music scene that was really, you know, vital and people really are nostalgic for right now and probably always will be, Other Music was probably as close a thing to that scene as CBGB's was to the late 70s punk scene in New York. It was really kind of the epicenter of everything. All these bands like Interpol, Yeah Yeah Yeahs, TV on the Radio, The Strokes were all part of the scene at the store, selling their music there on consignment before they were signed to any record labels at all, on CDRs or self-pressed, you know, 7 inches and things like that.
Yeah.
So we felt like we had to document this place that was really personally important and emotional to us, but also was really a relevant place in the history of New York music.
You know, the clubs get all the glory, and the stages that have hosted great bands are fondly remembered. But there are other centers of musical community, sometimes recording studios. How is it that a retail business, because it was a business, you have a lot of great scenes of people coming in and dropping $600, $800, $1,000 at a time on rare krautrock records and forgotten Dusty's soul, right?
Come on. I wasn't putting your taste on someone else. It's really about, like, talking to the customer and getting what they're looking for and understanding where they're coming from and being able to take what they tell you and recommend something that they'll like.
Holy, this one is amazing.
Yeah. Martin Newell is the gentleman who is in Cleaners from Venus. It's like a lo-fi, had an indie pop thing.
Paloma, speak to that. Did you feel welcome the very first time you went in Other Music?
Oh my gosh, the first time I went in, I was terrified. You know, you think you know a lot about music, and then you go into a place like that and you're like, oh my gosh, I don't know most of these artists. And, yeah, you know, so I kind of like shyly looked around, and honestly, I kind of ran out of there, like, being really scared. But there was so much stuff in there that looked amazing, and I wanted to feel okay to go back in. And yeah, like maybe the first 10 or even 20 times I went into other music, I felt scared and like, oh, maybe I'm not smart enough to be in here, or maybe I don't know enough about music. But, you know, slowly, slowly I started buying things, and, you know, the employees started talking to me, and you just realize that people that love music just love music, and they just want to talk about it.
Before the internet and before iPhones or any of that, like, people trusted other people.
These were two tracks that were on a deluxe like CD set of like greatest hits.
Yeah, he did vocals on the original track. The Sam Carriage one is really good.
They're kind of like a bit darkness. Like the darkness.
Don't judge me. I have a soft spot for the darkness. Yeah, I can appreciate
it. Talk about me when I leave.
You know, it really felt like a salon. People would just go and stand around and talk for hours.
Yeah.
And you could join in, or you could like eavesdrop, and it was all just like very educational and exciting for a young person at the time.
I was shocked by how two of the three founders, the two who continued, often couldn't take a salary. You know, they had this high water mark in the early 2000s. And then challenge number one, you know, streaming is beginning to happen and downloads. It's like the last 18 years or so where they were slowly going down the toilet the whole time.
Yeah, I mean, I think the sustainable model nowadays of a record store is like one guy that sits in there every day the whole time that it's open and sells a lot of used records with a high profit margin. And, you know, hopefully some new releases that they make a couple bucks on. It's really hard to pay the rent and have merchandise on the shelf and pay employees. And, you know, other music was in the heart of Manhattan, surrounded by high-end retail.
Yeah.
Very high rents. They paid their staff more than minimum wage, gave people health care, which
yeah,
is,
they
we don't
gave
even,
them benefits.
Not even mentioned in the film, really, I don't think. But
yeah. I mean, they're just like such good people. Even all the employees that left, they would still get the discount like 10 years after they left. Rob would benefit from that. Whenever we wanted to buy a new record, we would go to Other Music because he still got his discount, which is kind of messed up. We probably like contributed to them going out of business in a way.
What are they doing now?
Josh got a job working for Secretly Canadian Distribution. So he helps them sign new labels up to be distributed by Secretly Canadian. Chris now helps run a Trader Joe's in Tribeca. And I think everybody realized during this pandemic just how vitally important running a grocery store is.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, when people are struggling, there's nothing more important than that. And Chris has been really passionate about that work. And it's been a wild ride for him. I mean, their Trader Joe's was really hit hard by COVID. Lots of employees got it. Chris got it. Lost his sense of smell and taste for months and months.
Yeah. Wow. You know, Chris described working at Trader Joe's like it was record store day every day because so many people would come in every day. And, you know, he is the sort of person who just loves talking to people all day and helping customers like in person. So he didn't want to not have like that every day in his life. He needed that constant interaction with people. And a lot of his other music regulars still come, and they, you know, Rollerblading Mike is one of the regulars who rollerblades into Trader Joe's and visits him, you know. So he still has like the cast of characters who used to go into to Other Music still visit him there.
The first couple of years, it was like nowhere I'd ever worked before. It was crazy. Just from the amount of personalities you had to interact with on the staff, and then the amount of people that were coming in the store, and that amount of traffic coming to you all day long, going, well, what do you like? Or what does this sound like? Or what, you know, it was just like, oh my God, like, I'm exhausted.
There's some member of any group that was of any importance, except the Strokes, I guess, in the early 2000s New York scene is in this film. It seemed like they were probably knocking down your door to be in the movie.
Yeah, people were eager. I mean, the Strokes, I think we reached out to them at various times. They all watched the movie after it was finished and said they loved it. they were hard to pin down for interviews. But Bjork is somebody who was a really, really frequent customer.
We would have loved to have had her in the film, but, you know, she's Bjork.
Yeah.
Has a lot of layers between her and you know, regular people like us. So.
But people generally were very eager to talk about the store because it was an important place to them. And, you know, people like Benicio del Toro just wandering in one of the first days that we were filming, you know, was more than happy to sit down and do an interview, which it was not a bother or an imposition. He wanted to talk about why he loved this place.
Yeah, even, you know, people like Jason Schwartzman, our friend Alex Ross Perry, who's a film director. Jason was in one of his films, and so we asked him to connect us. And I guess, like, he texted Jason, and Jason was like, yeah, tell them to text me. And that was it. It was just like, you know, a week later, we were sitting with him.
Ezra from Vampire Weekend and Matt from The National, just like Tunde from TV on the radio, all just sat down and couldn't stop talking about everything that was great about the store for 2-3-4 hour interviews.
Actually, Matt from The National, his interview was so long and I was really, really pregnant at the time. And Rob wasn't on that interview. It was just me. And, you know, when you're pregnant, you have to go to the bathroom a lot. And I was like, I would have to, like, be like, would you mind just pausing that thought for a minute? I had to do that, like, 5 times. But,
so let me ask you, you know, I was talking about the clerks being great curators, right? The depth of knowledge.
One of my all-time favorites, Keith Hudson. Super spooky reggae, but a no less spiritually minded left of center vocalist.
You sold me on that one right away. That's
like, that's absolutely awesome. Classic record.
Yeah. How did they go about sharing that knowledge without being intimidating?
They were very selective about who they hired, first of all. I mean, it took a really specific type of person to be able to do that job. You just had to, you know, start on day one with a huge amount of music knowledge existing, and then also to just stay engaged with everything coming out and keeping your ears open and your mind open.
You know, having seen Duane Harriott in action, talking to people about music more than the rest of the clerks, the first thing he would do would ask you what you liked. So he would get you to open up, you know, this is my favorite, you know, I'm really into this right now. And it could be something that he hates, right? But he would really, really listen. And then he would start making connections from that to what he really liked. And before you know it, they're listening to all of his, you know, favorite music. You know? But yeah, you know, I think that that was the way that they tried to reel people in by, like, making them feel comfortable talking about what they loved first.
And that is not something an algorithm is ever going to
do. Yeah, exactly.
And it was really about relationships. You would see people coming in again day after day, week after week, year after year, and they would, a lot of them have their one or two people that they had built this sort of musical dialogue with.
Yeah. And, you know, I think everyone had kind of a relationship with, like, a clerk or two clerks, and they would go when they were working and feel comfortable to just, you know, talk about everything.
Is that how you two met?
We met through Duane Harriott, who's one of my dearest friends and who Rob worked with for a long time. He saw us talking and he was like, oh my God, like, you guys actually need to know each other. You know, he was like, this is perfect.
So curating music, curating relationships.
Yeah. We tried for a couple days, our editor Greg and I, like, really tried to see if we could put a little bit of a segment in about all the people that met their future spouses at Other Music, because there were so many of them. Even
Bill Callahan
even talked about
his wife at Other Music.
He met his wife at Other Music.
Well, that's gonna be on the DVD outtakes. Speaking of release, you know, no theatrical release, the world has ended, but you guys came up with a way to give back in terms of streaming this film.
Yeah, so the movie was supposed to open on April 15th at IFC Center in New York and a bunch of other theaters around the country and around the world. As that date approached in mid-late March, we were realizing, well, that's probably not going to happen. We started talking, do we wait? Do we delay it? And then we started reading about this thing called virtual cinema that was just brand new at the time and now kind of is everywhere. And we decided that we would rent the film online, but instead of putting it on Amazon or iTunes, we would have a link that would be sold by individual record stores and movie theaters.
You know, these places are really important to us, and making this film, you know, and going through the pandemic, kind of thinking about it, we realized, like, wow, we might come out of this pandemic and all these places yeah. will be gone. And that's just not a world I want to be a part of.
Yeah.
It was really important to us that we were able to do it this way. And we had over 200 record stores and theaters around the world that participated. And yeah, we're just really, really happy that we got to do it that way.
We have been talking to director and producer Paloma Basu, and Rob Hatch Miller made the other music doc. Thank you for giving us your thoughts about not only the film, but record stores in general.
Thanks, Jen.
Thank you so much for having us.
What else do you have? Give me something fresh. You have something fresh?
Other Music is available now on Amazon Prime, and most places you can rent movies online. Coming up, we'll hear from two record store owners fighting to keep their stores from the fate Other Music met. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from Chicago and distributed by PRX.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot. And this week, we are looking at the independent music industry ecosystem, another element of it, specifically record stores. Before the coronavirus shut down everything earlier this year, there was already enormous pressure on independent mom-and-pop record stores. The major label's distribution was all consolidated into one company, which was not up to the task, to put it mildly. Stores all over the place reported inventory taking weeks and months longer to show up than expected, if it showed up at all.
Yeah, Jim, then there was this fire that destroyed part of the production process to cut new vinyl. Of course, we know coronavirus upended expectations all around. So now we want to talk with some record store owners to hear how they're faring after more than 6 months of this uncertainty. First up, we have Brittany Benton, a DJ, producer, and the owner of Brittany's Record Shop in Cleveland, Ohio.
So the shop, I would say it is located at the intersection of 65th and Fleet in Cleveland. I would say it's a celebration of black music and culture. A lot of people like to move around that word, but no, I focus on hip hop, reggae, soul, and jazz. I wanted to create a niche community out of what I saw was lacking in Cleveland. We have about at least a half dozen shops independent, and that's really good for the city Cleveland size. But, you know, it was just, to me, I felt like it was rock,
yeah.
Classic rock, this, and it was cool, but, you know, I felt also if I were asking about hip hop, they would look at me saying, like, to have a sense of pride, like, we don't sell that you know what here, you know, and it was just like, get out of here, just treat it like some kind of riffraff. And I felt like I got sick of being followed through the store so I don't steal anything. And I noticed that things changed once I got recognized as a DJ and a musician. And I started talking to other black crate diggers, DJs, you know, record collectors, and they were talking about the treatment that they got. You know, they were just like, well, that's why I usually dig out of town, or I just dig online or on Discogs. And I wanted to create the environment that was not just welcoming to my own, but welcoming to everyone. I see a lot of young people who their first vinyl experience is shopping with me, and that's people of all races, and they feel, you know, comfortable right at home. There's somebody making beats over there. I have a set of turntables set up right at the door, so DJs come in and spin, so they get to see vinyl being used in every aspect of like hip hop or DJ culture, and they see how central it is to the community. Vinyl is central to the DJ world, even though most DJs don't use vinyl anymore. Hip hop is the leading genre in the world, but it's still based on turntables and vinyl. Like, it's still central to the DNA. And so I feel like it's a little mini cultural center, gallery space, and it's just like a little, it's like a little soul shack, you know?
Brittany, in retrospect, you opened towards the end of March 2019 in Cleveland. Probably not a super smart business decision then, given the challenges record stores are facing. And then the world ended a year later in March of 2020. Are you hanging in there with the store?
I've only seen like exponential growth post March this year. Really? You know, even after I had to shut down for about 5 weeks, the brick and mortar. But because I had a website that was in place, and I was always very active on social media, which I think versus the other record stores in the area and in general, you know, I don't think they're owned by millennials. So, you know, being so active on social media, already having the full website set up for e-commerce, things just scaled up amazingly. So, yeah. I mean, the thing is I was looking at, you know, how at first when everything shut down, how was I going to keep the shop open? Because I didn't know what was going to happen. But little by little, I just started getting more and more orders. And then I'll say what makes my situation extremely unique is, I don't know, I might be the only Black woman in the country that owns a record store. Yeah. So when Black Tuesday happened, my shop must have caught on to some algorithm. And fortunately, I was listed in this piece by OK Player about 8 Black-owned record shops to support. Mm. I just, like, it just blew up after that.
That is fantastic to hear.
So, yeah, it was completely the opposite.
From the beginning, as much of your vision for it was, yeah, sell records, right, sell music, but also you wanted a center of culture.
Yeah.
And right now, we can't have that. We did a story a couple of weeks ago about the fate of live music, and it's just dire. We might not be able to gather in any number to enjoy the sort of concerts we all love before the end of 2021. You know, so that part of it has to have you a little sad.
Yeah, absolutely. At the shop, I was always from the perspective of, you know, music, whether it's soul or hip hop, it's not so much a commodity, but, you know, it was an action, something that was participatory, you know, being a DJ, you know, I'd been in several groups and whatnot. So we actively participated. And so I wanted my spot to be a place for that. So, you know, I would have monthly beat makers nights where I'd have a lineup of producers every weekend. I have DJs come in and spin vinyl, and I would even do little pop-up shows. So I would say, because I have a smaller shop and because of social distancing and slashed capacities, it's like I can't have those events where I have a standing crowd of like 20 extra people plus people digging for records.
Yeah.
Because I don't want people waiting outside to come and dig because somebody's, you know, jamming to the DJ.
Right.
You know, so, you know, I've been experimenting with other things like via live streams and still interactive, like where I can, trying to make the best of it. But, you know, it's definitely changed some things.
You know, you were shut down for a couple of weeks, couple of months
mm-hmm.
for the pandemic. What did you have to do to get ready to reopen? Plexiglass, hand sanitizer, masks?
Well, basically, I just had to adhere to the capacity, because my shop is small. It's like 500 square feet, yeah. And it's just really records and the turntable. So I believe my capacity right now is like 7 or 8 people. So
okay.
It's, you know, it's really one person per crate.
Yeah.
I just have to keep an eye on capacity, because certain days, or if they find out somebody's DJing, I have to kind of make it seem like it's something I'll stream, but I'm not encouraging people to come unless they want to buy records. But also because a lot of people have been a lot more wary about going out and about, the website has seen just exponential growth.
Yeah.
I've always had customers who were, you know, they used to come to my old record store when I was on the west side, but they were like, yo, we're not coming to the hood. So if as long as you put stuff online, we'll buy it and you just ship it to us, you know. So it went from people who were just like that to, yo, I'm afraid to leave the house, but I need some entertainment. I'm going crazy. And now I'm shipping. Or then people are like, yo, I found this hashtag about you being a Black-owned shop. I'm from Poland, you know, and like it was crazy.
That's
you
great.
Know, like now most of my customer base is from Los Angeles, you know, so
wow.
It's just a total change. So really right now, my new normal is just maintaining the pace with the online store. And I've always been open just half the week to the public.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it works itself out. You know, it's like I haven't missed any meals over the pandemic, fortunately.
Cool. We have been talking to Brittany Benton, DJ and record store owner in Cleveland, Brittany's Record Shop. Thank you, Brittany, for coming on Sound Opinions.
Thank you for having me.
I want to make a road trip now. Get some pierogies and go
cool
by Brittany's record shop.
Yeah, pierogies, hit up a microbrewery and, you know, do it up the Cleveland way.
All right, we want to talk to a record store owner in Asheville, North Carolina. Not just a record store owner, the owner of one of the coolest record stores in America, Mark Capon, Harvest Records. Welcome to Sound Opinions.
Thank
Mark.
You. And I should say I am co-owner with my friend Matt Schnabel. I just don't want him to.
Oh, okay. Lose. All right. Yeah. So we want to check in with record stores like your own across the country. It was a challenging time a year ago. But if times were challenging, merely having you bite your nails a year ago, they've had to be absolutely harrowing since the COVID shutdowns.
Indeed. Yeah. My nails are, they're pretty raw at this point, but yeah, it's been an interesting challenge, but to be totally honest, it's given me and Matt, my business partner, a level of rejuvenation of getting deep into the bowels of the record store and figuring out, okay, what do we need to change? What's going to work now? Like, how do we adapt in a way that honestly, it feels almost like it felt 16 years ago when we were opening the store, when we were just here all the time, just kind of like figuring it all out, as opposed to it running like a well-oiled machine, which is, you know, it's not doing right now.
What prompted you to open a record store a mere 16 years right. ago? Record stores were already dying.
They were, yeah. We got a lot of sideways looks and, you know, our parents kind of rolled their eyes. And in 2004, it definitely was a, you know, the vinyl resurgence had not happened yet. So the only way that I can really explain it is that Matt and I were fresh out of college with a lot of hopes and dreams and naivety, and we just said, let's move to a cool place and open a record store and try to make it work. And our goal was always to have shows and have in-stores and have art on the walls and all of these things that just to make it beyond just the normal record store experience. I think in 2004, it was a weird time because, you know, CDs were still dominant. Records only took up a small part of the floor when we opened. I think we just believed in the idea of we're going to create a space that's fun and engaging and welcoming to whoever wants to come in and talk about music. It was as simple as that. And never did we have dollar signs in our eyes or anything because that had kind of already faded. You know, that was already like, you don't get into record stores to make money. So that we didn't really care about that. It was just more like, let's make a cool place in a cool town. And that's what we did.
How are you coping in the COVID world? Mm-hmm. Am I able to walk in to Harvest Records today?
So you are not able to walk in, and you wouldn't have been able to walk in since I think it was March 16th or 17th. But what happened then is we basically took a month off for everyone just to stay home and do nothing. And then later in April, we started to come back and started doing curbside pickup. And, you know, we started upping our mail order game and also putting some stuff up online on Discogs that we normally didn't have as much stuff up on there. And then also we started offering local deliveries, which people take us up on sometimes, which is pretty fun.
Wow. You get in the car.
I get in the car.
And you drop off my Wilco record.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm like, let me know somewhere where it's not going to be in direct sunlight so that we don't want the records to get warped. But I used to deliver pizza for many years, and I loved that job so much. And so this kind of brought back some of that love. I really enjoy it. I love driving, and it was nice to kind of get around town and you know, people were always so excited when they would see it pull up. It's like bringing a pizza or something. Like, it's all, yeah. Someone delivering something in your house, generally, you're pretty excited about it. So it was a nice vibe.
But there is no streaming service algorithm that is going to do
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
When, realistically, can you have those in-stores, those conversations, those shoppers?
Technically, we can now, and we could have for the last couple of months, to be honest, mm-hmm. Legally, you know. But honestly, we're going to stay closed in this way indefinitely until we know that it's safe. We just felt, for a million different reasons, that it was still not the right thing to do. We don't want our employees, if we bring them back, getting sick. We don't want to get sick. We don't want to spread it. We don't want, you know, it's a tactile experience in here. Everyone's touching things all the time, flipping through, you know. As much as we could enforce rules and 6 feet and all of that, it just still feels irresponsible. I'm not placing judgment on places that have opened, because we have friends with businesses down on the street that have opened and they have done okay, and that's fine. But we've just felt it's really important for us to stand our ground until we know it's safe.
That is not a capitalist attitude, Mark, but a noble one.
We've made a lot of adjustments in how can we keep the door closed, but still try to sell as many records as possible. And we've found a lot of cool, interesting ways to do things that we didn't really think of before, that it's helping keep the doors open. And honestly, people are really appreciative of, especially our local customers are just really appreciative that we're doing anything at all and still able to get them records, because they're still stuck at home, and records are good to have when you're stuck at home. And
yeah,
so it's been okay. We felt really strongly loved by our community. It's nice.
That's a wonderful thing. But nothing is going to beat me being able to go through those stacks and find something. I can't leave your store without.
No, it's true. I mean, the best we got right now is two or three days a week, I just film myself flipping through used records. and like, that's the best experience we can get for most people. But I will tell you this. They are rabid when we post those videos. It is wild. I mean, if those same people came in and flipped through that same stack of records just in here like a normal day a year ago, they might not buy much. But when they see it on the video, there's become this like really rabid competitive thing. And so people are just like,
I gotta get there first.
Yes, they're just like, dibs on the Buddy Holly, dibs on Billie Holiday, dibs on Tom Petty. And it's just like, it goes so fast. It's crazy. It's really exciting.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
That is absolutely brilliant. We have been talking to Mark Capon, co-owner of Harvest Records in Asheville, North Carolina. I so want to come visit you now, Mark.
Come on down. I mean, you know, we can make an appointment for you. If you want to travel,
okay.
Come on down.
Well, because the Moog factory is in your town as well.
Oh, yeah, just down the street.
I'm going to move there and never leave.
All right, Jim, while we're on the record store tip here, on that subject, you told me an intriguing story that while we were doing the Other Music interview, some information came out of that about regarding Amy Mann and a cat. Is that right?
Looking into the face of the good snow cone.
I got to ask you, so Amy Mann wrote a song about your cat?
It's true.
It's true.
Amy Mann, friend of Sound Opinions, probably one of the coolest people I've ever met in my life. Having a song about your cat written by Amy Mann is even cooler.
Well, so Rob and I produced two music videos for Amy.
Mm-hmm. We produced two music videos for an album called Charmer.
It's a great, yeah. great record.
And that's how we met Amy. And, you know, actually, while we were filming those two music videos, we made them at the same time. We had just found our cat Goose on the street. And so during filming, we were showing her, look at our new kitten, you know, and Amy loves cats. And I don't know what happened, but Amy just fell in love with Goose. And it came to a point at which she would come to New York and she would say, hey, can I come over to your apartment to hang out with Goose? And, you know, and
not you no. two, but
and
yeah.
And we'd be like, Rob would be like, hey, I'm like really working on a stressful shoot and I won't be able to talk to you, and I would be at work and I'd be like, Amy, I'm not even home. And she'd be like, I don't care, I'll just, you know, come and play with Goose for a while. And she actually did that a couple times. And then, like, she was on tour in Ireland and it was a really cold day, I think, and she decided to write a song, and somehow she wrote the lyrics. It was all about our cat Goose. It just kind of, she saw a picture of Goose on Instagram and she wrote the song and she sent it to us. It was just recorded on her phone and we thought, oh, haha, Amy wrote a song about our cat, you know. We didn't think much of it. And then we were visiting LA soon afterwards and we went and got breakfast with Amy, and she was like, hey, do you guys want to come to the studio? I'm doing the string section for the Goose song tomorrow.
The string
yeah,
section?
Yeah, and we were like, what? You know, we just like couldn't believe it, that it actually ended up on the record. And then we ended up, you know, she was like, well, you guys have to make the video for the Goose song, and Goose has to be in it, and you have to be in it. And so
I think she was only using you to get to
Goose. I'm pretty sure she was, you know.
Which she's honest enough, she'd fess up. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a video for it and everything, and Goose is in it with in all her glory.
We also have in our living room an original painting of our cat Goose by Amy Mann.
Wow. Well, if you guys were more mercenary, I think you could have cashed in on Goose's fame, even if it's only a fan club of one with Amy Mann.
Yeah, we are not good at making money, I'll tell you that.
We're documentary filmmakers, you know.
Greg, that functioned sort of as a DIJ, the story of Amy Mann and a cat. What do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we have the story of Cream Magazine as told through the voice of legendary, and I don't use that term lightly, legendary critic Jan Uhelski, as well as an interview with Idols, one of the best new bands working today.
For more sound opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you get such thingies. This week, our Patreon supporters get more tape of our interview with Hannibal Buress, including the story of how he wound up directing one of Chance the Rapper's early videos. As always, Sound Opinions is produced by our ace and beloved team of Andrew Gill and Alex Claiborne.